Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast. Slacker
Podcast. Hello, Slackers. Season 4 is here. We have landed on episode 1. It has been, how long has it been? Like a month, 2 months since the last one. It is really good to spend some time in your company to provide a little interview, a little insight on some new artists for a brand new season. I hope you've been thriving. I hope your tomato plant that you told me you were growing is near picking, and that you've been safe and sound the last little while. I'm back outside. I'm back in the sun. I'm not freaking out as much as I once was, but that's not saying much considering I'm such a massive freak out. I've been bunkered down. I've been making a lot of content in the time between podcasts and taking some time to like figure out where I want the Slacker Podcast to go, because it's been going really well, and that's down to all of you guys listening to it and to all you guys sharing it with your friends as well, because I know like the main way that this podcast rolls is through word of mouth. So if you have been sharing it, thank you so much, and if you want to, then go right ahead. Normally with a season, I will hold all my cards close to my chest and I'll not tell you who's coming up, and it'll be a surprise every Tuesday. Do you know what? Let's throw it out the window for this season. I'll tell you who we got in season 4, and it's big, right? Next week on the podcast, we have got Run the Jewels. Yeah, it's going to be a big one. Coming up on season 4, we have got Haim. We have got Phoebe Bridgers. We have got Bob Geldof. We have got Johnny Burrell. We have got KSI. We have got Phineas. We have got Leanne Lajavas. We have got Alan McGee, MJ Cole, Sleaford Mods, Idols, Sean Paul, and there is a whole host of other ones that I'm working on. This season is going to be a long one. I'm going to give you guys so much content week after week after week after week, because I know now that I can record these from my house and they can still sound good, and I'm going to record video of it as well. The Slacker Podcast is leveling up so hard this one, and a lot of that is down to the faith and the love that has been shown by the Slacker Patreons. Like, big up to those guys. They've shown me that not everyone considers podcasts that they just have to be free, that they have to be throwaway content. Like, we've got a small crew of patrons over at the Slacker Patreon, and they're just a bunch of legends. So, like, you know, big up to those guys for supporting the podcast and giving me the onus to keep it going and make it better and make more of the podcasts. So if you want to become a Slacker patron, it's patreon.com/slackerpodcast. I do a Slacker Patreon only podcast, only for people who subscribe, and that goes out every single Tuesday. You get access to live podcasts, you get playlists that I make for everyone on streaming platforms, you got live tickets when we're back at that, and loads of other bits and pieces at the patreon.com/slackerpodcast. Also, I'm really excited about this, because this Friday I am doing a pilot of a brand new style of Slacker podcast. And it's going to be on the same RSS feed as this. You'll be able to get this as well. And it's completely different to the interview style, but it is all based around music, and it's based around... I don't want to give too much away on that one. No, I don't, because I'm pretty excited about it. It's called Slacker Friends, and I need to pilot it because I just need to see what works and what doesn't work. But that's going to come out very, very soon. So I'm making so much content at the minute and doing loads of interviews. And I've got some really exciting podcasts coming up that I haven't recorded yet. So yeah, big time. Let's get on to episode one of season four. We have got an OG songwriter, 10 years deep in the game right now, and probably one of the most interesting modern artists in Ireland. His name is James Vincent McMorrow. Feel with like a lot of Irish artists, there can be a tendency to maybe look back for a little bit of like retroism. With him, he's definitely somebody who wants to push the genre forward, and that genre doesn't even exist. I don't know what he's pushing for, but he's trying to push music forward in 2020, and he's on his fifth album, which is coming out this year. He's done a bit of writing for the likes of Drake, for Division, amongst many others, and someone who I rotate heavily on my Chilla show on Radio 1 for anybody who listens to it. And yeah, stacked season of the podcast, and we're going to just keep going week after week. Next week, Run the Jewels. This week, first episode of Slacker season 4. Here's James Vincent McMorrow.
I think a part of my not intentional mystique as a musician has been just down to the fact that I just never really liked being on camera. So I never really put myself out there on social media or in interviews. So I'm trying to fix that a little bit, because yeah, I actually quite like it. I like talking to you. It's nice. It's not.
Oh, you won't by the end of it. Like, you'll be like, who the fuck booked that in for me?
Yeah. Who set up this fucking prick?
Well, here we are.
Yeah, like, I'm just, yeah.
But here we are. Like, we're all new. Slacker podcast with James Vincent McMorrow. And yeah, this is the first one I've done this way, which is like down the line.
I've got no choice.
Like, I can't fly over to Ireland and sit beside you and whisper sweet nothings in your ear. Like, we might kill each other.
Not intentionally, just passively through infections.
How have you dealt with the lockdown and all the rest of that? Like, I've been slowly going out of my brain for the first 2 weeks, and I feel like I'm starting to get over the hill a little bit now with it.
Yeah, I'm starting to lock into a bit of a rhythm. I mean, like, I would say this, my life has been pretty self-isolated for the vast majority of my adult life.
Yeah.
So this is not, it's not a jarring change for me. I'm not even joking. Like, I mean, my day is not wildly different. I wake up and I make music, and then I just hang out at home, and I'm pretty low key.
We're going to play a demo of Get Low in just a little minute, because I want to know how your self-made haircut went, because I've got mine, and it's getting really, really long, and I was gonna get a cut just before Oblivion. For anybody that's listening to this, we are recording this on April Fool's Day, the 1st of April. And I was dying to get a haircut, and I'm tempted to go and cut it myself, but I didn't.
Because my hair's got quite long, and I just literally just like grabbed it and just hacked it off. So it's not graceful, but like, it gets it done. Like, who cares? Like, honestly, bigger things to worry about. Like, I would be lying if I said it was the first time I had given myself a haircut. It is not. Because I'm just don't give a shit. I'm just,
you musicians, you crazy bunch.
Well, I don't live in a world where I need to really care about that. So I don't. I don't know. Because I just like, if I'm just like in a bad mood, I'll just like cut it all off or something like that, or just let it grow. When I'm making records, I don't cut it. I just let it grow. It's kind of become a weird like ritual of mine. So that's why it's gotten quite.
You make it sound like you're Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver. When you get angry, you cut your hair like you shave it into a mohawk and walk around town looking for some
not quite
ultraviolence.
That extreme, man. Yeah.
So let's get into playing this demo now. It's a demo
from which album is this? This is Get Low.
It's from the third record. Yeah, it's from the album We Move. So it's Get Low. Is that from that record?
Right, here it is.
Yeah.
I think we're getting married. Everybody says greatest man alive. I've been told by myself and I. Finally getting paid by people's silence. And they're afraid. Causing threat of violence. It works. It can get you so far. End up feeling worse. It's cold. Then you have no fun.
Right, there you go. That's our demo. That was James Vincent McMorrow. The track was called Get Low. And what sort of like iteration of the demo was that? Was that like the last version before it was finished? Was that the very first bit that came to you?
No, I think that was like maybe halfway through. I usually do like 40 or 50 versions of each song.
40 or 50 versions of each song?
Yeah, easily. Like, I think that it's just always been part of my process. I mean, let's not get crazy. Like, that's not me saying like 40 or 50 profound versions of a song. That's just like 40 or 50 versions that are different iterations, or I want to try different things, or I want to work with different people. That version was the first one that I worked with the producer that ultimately helped me finish it, Canadian guy called 1985. And that was the first one that I gave him a bunch of like audio, like the vocals and some of the other bits and pieces and the synths, and he put the drums on it. So I'd kind of been struggling with that. But man, there's so many versions of that song. There's one that sounds very like Steely Dan. That's like very like you have Toto in the background. I think there's, it sounds, the drums on it are very like Jeff Beccaro. It has that kind of drum thing. Yeah. I was trying a lot of different stuff. I think at that point I knew I wanted to add some more like elements that were like more on the hip hop lean, because that's sort of, that's what I've always wanted. But it's the one thing that I'm sort of not, I'm not vocabulary wise in the studio. I can do it, but I know that there's people that can do it better and easier because they just work in systems like Ableton or Fruity Loops that just mean they can get to the heart of it much quicker and more with more finesse than I can.
Isn't Fruity Loops quite like a basic like piece of
Is it not? Fruity Loops,
I don't know. I've never used
anymore.
It. No?
Not anymore. No, it's like a proper, like I would say 70% of the rap you hear at the moment, the beats will probably come out of Fruity Loops. For drums, it's great, the sequencer in it. Because like when I was a kid, I had Fruity Loops on like my computer, and I used to just mess with the little like 16-step sequencer. But like all of the rap guys did that. I used it as a joke when we were kids. We used to just make beats on it just for fun, and then I would go to Logic, or I think I had like Cubase was the first thing I ever used. And they took it and ran with it and just like turned it into this like multi-billion-dollar empire of beat making, because it works so fast. It's like a computer game. And if your brain, if you were raised with that idea of like music is like a computer game almost, I think that like Fruity Loops is very appealing. Same with Ableton. I think that's why people like Ableton as well. It's because you can use it in a way that's a bit more visual. I use Logic because I used to just work in audio.
Yeah.
So those guys, they work in that world, and something, it spits out sound that I just find compelling. So I was just trying to get to that world a little bit more. And 85, just, you know, we talked about doing stuff for ages, and I'd played him a couple of songs off the record, and he was a big fan of the second album. So it just kind of made sense to pursue it. I knew I needed other people at that album. I wasn't really kind of looking to do it myself.
What is the like the vibe with like your man 1985? Because he's like a, you know, he's obviously the sort of producer du jour for people like Drake, and you know, you've worked with him as well. Is it simply just that he was born in 1985? I've wanted to know this for ages. Or did he just like sit there one day and his name's like Norman Gooferson or something, and he was just like, I need a studio name.
Well, I mean, rap, you know, like the rap world revolves around like monikers and names, right? Like, so like, you know, Drake isn't Drake, you know. Yeah, but like he was born in 1985, that's why he picked it. But his name is Paul Jeffries, you know. It's like, I'm not sure if Paul Jeffries walks in his studio if that says like, you know, it's a solid name, but like in the rap world, you know.
Yeah, like I mean, like, you know, like when you've got the producers that they've got their like little audio signature that they have at the start of a track, like Steel Bangles would be like, I can't remember what Steel Bangles is, but like, you know, DJ Khaled just has his, but it's just DJ Khaled.
He's just yelling.
Just like the idea of Paul Jeffries.
85 doesn't have a vocal tag, actually. No, he does. Like, I worked on this new album, I worked a bit with a producer called Kenny Beats. And Kenny has one that's like, whoa, Kenny. And he wouldn't put it on the record, like, because I think he was very respectful to my process. Like, because he usually does a lot of like very ratchet rap records. And the thing we did is it's almost like a garage rock kind of record. And I really wanted him to use the vocal tag. And he just was like, he just didn't want to. He wanted to like be respectful to the record. So I kind of slipped it in by like taking the whoa part of it and putting it in the chorus underneath my vocals. Cause I was just like obsessed with the idea of like, I grew up listening to rap. So the idea of having like vocal tags on records is very appealing to me, but he wanted to just make it very like authentic to the work. So I slipped it in. He doesn't even know. I literally cut it. I like off of like an audio stream and had to like put it in myself because I just thought it was a funny thing to do.
You got
like a little
do
Easter
it.
Egg or something for people. Yeah.
But did you like, so you're releasing, did you see like your new album's a garage rock album?
No. There's one record. I mean, this album is wild, man.
Yeah.
No, I mean, like, you know, my musical history is pretty wild. Like I just, I've never thought about stuff in a very linear fashion. You know, that's the reason why I would work with someone like 85. When I made that record, like, I'm not trying to big myself up here or any bullshit, but like, you know, when I made that record, I think there was a lot of pushback from certain people within my camp about the idea of like working with, like trying to extrapolate the singer-songwriter thing and frame it around like more overtly hip hop sounds instead of ratchet. Like the 808s on the finished version of Get Low are pretty massive. So like trying to put all that stuff together was not something that a lot of people had done before very successfully. And I'm not like putting my hand up and saying like I'm the guy who pioneered that shit, but like at the same time, it wasn't a well-trodden track. So,
that's where the most interesting music comes from, is like when it just looks like it shouldn't work on paper, but it does. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But you have to put in a lot of work to make it work. I think like that's the stupidest thing I've ever said. You have to put in a lot of work to make it work. What I mean is that like all of what I was saying about doing like 30 or 40 versions of songs, all of that preamble was required so that when I eventually went to 85 with what I had, I knew that he could add to it in a way that would be sympathetic to it and not overpower it and vice versa. So like, I think that that's what I mean about putting in that work ahead of time.
Did you try it out with other hip hop producers? Like, was he the first one that you went to, or like, did you sort of struggle to find the right person?
No, with that song, I went to him. I essentially like opened up my folders of things that I thought were in the running for the album to two or three people. So like I had three producers that I liked. My friend, 2 Inch Punch from the UK. A guy called Frank Dukes from Toronto as well. And then 85. And so like I essentially went to them and said, this is what I have. And you're the three people that I think would work across all of this. So essentially put your hand up if you want to do any of it. And yeah, like that was, you know what I mean? Yeah. You're taking a certain risk, but I was pretty confident that they were the right people, and I have a huge amount of respect for them. So it was insulated to a degree because I'm not a guy that like just throws stuff at the wall. Like I've done this pretty successfully by myself up to that point, and I knew if I was going to include people in it, I was going to do the research and make sure that these were people that I had a relationship with and knew well, and that would add to something that would actually benefit it, rather than just going, well, this is the hot producer of the day, so like you got to get in and do stuff.
Yeah,
people pitch that shit all the time, but like I'm never one for that. Like I'll do the thing that is best, not the thing that is hypest.
I think that's the best way to approach things. But like, surely you must have had a lot of that as well, considering that you write songs for other people and have like done some production for other people. You've had your door beaten down by other artists to work with. Like, what's it like on the other side of it when it comes to writing with somebody else? Like, do you have to be picky with who you do it with, or do you get the opportunity to be able to go, listen, I'm not the right person to work with here on this?
I mean, I'll always open it up and see, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I'll take a lot of stuff at face value. Like, I'm not like, I get pitched a lot of like cold stuff, as in like there's no conversation beforehand. People are just like, we have this record and we think it needs something. I'm not really into that. I like the idea of, I'm not the guy that's like we need to sit in a room and like drink wine and talk about music for 5 hours. I think you can get some people really thrive on that. You know, like Rick Rubin is obviously the nth degree of producer, and he's that guy. He'll like sit in a room with people, and I'm not comparing,
but is there like I think about this, right? I think about people like him and Jimmy Iovine, right? And part of me thinks, with producers like that, how much of it is genuine talent, how much of it is their actual mistake that is built up over the years, which is the artist actually believes, and how much of it is just them absolutely bluffing it? Because like do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
Rick Rubin's essentially a musical life coach rather than like a producer or anything.
I mean I think that it's a little from columns A, B, and C in all of the great producers. I think you have to have a certain amount of musical knowledge, not even musical knowledge. I don't want to say, I think there's people that are brilliant and actually don't play anything. Like Jimmy Iovine is a perfect example. I mean, I don't know Jimmy Iovine to be a player. I know him to be an orchestrator, someone that can get in a room and demand something from people in almost like an iron willed type of way. And yeah. I think that there's benefit to that. I think it's like, but he came up obviously, you know, 70s and like, so he was in there like with Tom Petty and like, you know, there's those stories of him just like hammering the drummer into the ground just to try and get like, you know, those drum takes. And nowadays that's not even a conversation that would be required, but all of those guys did grow up in that, like Rick Rubin making records in the 80s on 8-tracks and stuff like that. Yeah. So these guys know how to get it done. But yeah, they all move into that sort of like guru Svengali type vibe because there is a benefit to it. I have lots of friends that have made records with Rick Rubin, and you know what? Some people will talk about it as the thing that saved their career, and some people will talk about it as the most pointless thing they've ever done. And that's no disrespect to Rick Rubin. It's the nature of the music business. It's like you have to know what you're looking to get out of this process. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not the guy for like a Rick Rubin process, because I just know that like I would be pulling at the thread of it, because I work with Paul Epworth on this album, the one that I just finished. And like Paul is the perfect person for me because he comes with that pedigree. I grew up obsessed with his work and he can get it done. In the same way that he has like that sort of like manic energy that I have in a studio where it's like childish, where he'll just jump on a drum kit or he'll jump on like a synthesizer and he'll just play instinctually and I feed off of that. Whereas those people that are very calm and put you in a zen space, it's a different thing. You know, I mean, people like 85, they're more functional, and I don't mean that in a negative way, because I think he's a brilliant musical mind. But with Get Low, there was a functionality required. I was like, I have this thing. I know what it could be. And I need someone to paint the picture. And within 15 minutes, I would say, in the studio in Toronto, he had like flipped my drums into something. Like what you hear there was enough in the demo was enough for me to be able to get on a plane and go, okay, I'm going to come to you and we're going to spend a week in a room.
Yeah, wow.
And he flipped that, and he flipped like there was a song called Rising Water that's on the album. That was like the first single. And it was like very, the version that I had come out of my studio, it was almost like a Bruce Springsteen record. It was very like, let's get in our car and drive. And his vibe, 85's vibe was, because it's coming from that OVO Drake camp, which is very minimal. And they were like, remove everything that you don't need. It was, again, it's kind of like this life lesson type thing. If you want to extrapolate these lessons from these guys, you can, because mm-hmm. it speaks to a wider thing. I was adding stuff. My vibe was additive. Constantly adding stuff to almost impress myself in the studio. Look at that chord I just figured out. Look at these sounds that I layered up. And he would just come in and be like, none of that's required, because like it's this, this, and this. They're the functional parts of this. And the song is the thing that people care about. So if you're not serving that goal, then you're wasting your time. And
I get
time.
That. I think that's a really important lesson. Like I mean, I sort of struggle with that a little bit too. It's something like, it's kind of like when you find something when you finally find something in your life that you want to be like, that you absolutely love, you want to be as good at it as you possibly can be. And sometimes by doing that is you accidentally maybe end up trying to show off to yourself more than anybody else. And you end up concentrating on not the thing that's important, but the thing that you think is the most impressive, which isn't the right way of doing it.
Yeah, what you're saying is completely, I think it speaks to like a lot of the human condition is like we're sort of built, I know I'm built to try and like impress like the person I've never met before. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like I'm a massive show-off.
We all are. Like, you know what I mean? Life is pretty curated, and you know, like everything we do is very forward-facing. Mm. Like it's very like built for like a filter and an idea, and it's a very like specific, narrow idea of you as a person, and you fill that void. You have to, everything you do is like filter into this very narrow thing. The idea of like blowing it very wide and being more chaotic is not something that everybody wants to do, because it's hard to do. You know what I mean? It's hard to just go, chaos is the vibe. I'm just going to go with that. So like everything tends to just get filtered into this very narrow thing. And that can be really good. It can, if you approach it the right way, you know, I needed that at that time in my life, because I think I had gotten very caught up in like trying to impress myself and then trying to impress the readers of Pitchfork or whatever. You know what I mean? It's like very that energy.
And like, I need a 79. I need an 84.
Yeah, like, bro, I mean, there was a moment in my life where like my world revolved around that a little bit, where you're like, you start course correcting in the studio based on like how you think this person that you've never met might perceive the thing. And that's like a really fucking, it's a lonely road to nowhere.
But I guess like the question is, that album that you did where you stopped caring about stuff like that, what score did you get in Pitchfork? And was it better?
I mean, It was better. I mean, like, I don't know the scores because I've actually never looked at the reviews. And I mean, I don't know. Good. But I remember with my second album, Post Tropical, I literally broke myself in half to make that album. And I'm incredibly proud of it. But I know that there were things that I did that I didn't need to do. I was doing stuff going above and beyond because I thought this is the thing that's required of me, and it wasn't. And I know that. I know that, like, what I've done since then, you know what I mean? When I went into the third album with a bit more of a sense of like, I'm going to do this. And I wouldn't even say that I achieved it on the third record. I didn't make this chaotic thing, that this thing that I wanted to make. There was still an amount of curation to it. But I remember after Post Tropical came out, the review, I didn't read it, but the review in Pitchfork was like relatively underwhelming, I think. And then I remember meeting the guy that wrote the review when he had moved to another company, and he interviewed me now. And this was what really spoke to me, was like, he essentially was just like, that was like my favorite album. But internally there just was a conversation about where it was supposed to be placed within our structure. And that was really telling to me, because
wow,
you're like,
that's,
okay, so
that's bullshit. Like, cause like I was a music journalist before I was on the radio. Mm. The idea of like towing a party line on what, whether an album is good or not, just makes me sick. Like,
yeah, I think that there was just when I heard that, was almost like relieved, because you're like, okay, cool. Like, and I don't know if he was just lying to me. Maybe he just didn't like the record. Maybe he was like, people are full of shit, you know, whatever. Yeah. But it fundamentally, it was interesting to me just to hear those things, because so much of your life is built around how you want people to perceive the thing that you do. And I think once I kind of liberated a certain amount of myself from that idea that like, oh shit, I have to work within this paradigm that the world has created for me. Like, I came out of the first album and I was like the singer songwriter guy with the beard, and I was like, I have a beard and I do enjoy solitude, but I was felt more complex than that. And then the second album,
do you think if you didn't have the beard, they would have put you in with like your James Morrisons, but because you got the beard, they put you in with Bon Iver?
I mean, I think that there is like a binary conversation, I guess, that happens for sure. I mean, I mean, no disrespect to James Morrison, I don't necessarily think musically we're in the same.
No, I know that, but I'm saying,
I know what you're like, saying. I get what you're saying. No, I'm not looking to diss anybody, and I'm not looking to like lay claim to any fucking grand. I'm just, yeah, I completely agree with you. I think that like, I wasn't on a major label either. No one wanted to sign me. You know what I mean? Like, I put out my first album and no one gave a shit for a year. And then the second year, a lot of people cared, and that was great. But
up on it by that stage? If nobody had cared for it in a year, had you thought, right, time to move on to album two?
No, I know. Like, I knew it was good. I mean, I'm a very like, there's a lot of warring principles within me as a person. And one of them is that like, I am very anxious as a human being, but I'm also probably one of the more self-possessed people on the planet, in the sense that like, I never doubted the thing that I was doing.
Yeah,
I didn't doubt the record. When people didn't want to sign it, I knew enough to know that like, me as a person, I think that when you're buying something as a record label, you're buying like a package. And I think that I would go in rooms and I would just sweat my way through a meeting, because I just didn't like making eye contact with people. And I didn't talk about the music the right way. I didn't know how to act. I didn't know how to play shows, because I really struggled in the first year. And I think had someone put a hand on my shoulder and said, listen, we see what's here, but we also see that there's things that need to be worked on. That would have been.
Had you not played shows that much up until the point of the debut album coming out?
No, not really.
Didn't like playing any bands when you were like a teenager or anything?
No, again, I was very nervous. I never sang out loud until I was probably like 22 or 23. I was very like shy is definitely, I wasn't a shy person. Like I would go out and I'd be quite sociable, but when it came to music, like no one heard anything. Like
stage fright.
I don't even know if it, like, yeah, I think just general sort of like life terror.
Life fright.
just the idea of people judging me. I think that that's something I've always struggled with. And that speaks to the nature of those, like, you know, getting reviewed and getting people talking about, oh, you're a white guy with a high voice, therefore you're like this and you're in this bracket and people judge you. And that's just the instinct. And I knew that from the outset, and it was not something I was very good with. So I think that I always wanted to impress people. I would go in rooms and probably try too hard. And so that was why no one cared, because I don't think that I built a world that they should care about. Like, I'm not knocking all those people for not seeing it, because I probably wasn't, you know, I wasn't the person I am now. So I went in there with like a lot of musical ideas, but very little ability to articulate it to a person in a room that needed to buy the idea.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
What was the change then? Like what made you more confident? Was it the simple process of doing it? Like, I mean, like, I've, like, you know, had suffered from anxiety and panic attacks and stuff my whole life. And the idea, everybody thinks it's mental, that I feel more at home doing radio than I do standing in the queue at the post office. But like the process of doing it and repeatedly doing it means that you kind of lose the fear of it. Was it just a constant thing of just having to hammer out doing the shows and getting better at it?
Yeah, pretty much. I think that, like, it's funny that you say that, use that analogy of the post office, because I actually think I've used that analogy before myself.
It must be just a common one.
Like, yeah, no, but no, but I do think that, like, I see a lot of commonalities and a lot of resonance in what you just said, that, like, I'm very lucky in the sense that, like, I put my first album out in 2010, which was, like, sort of the inception point of social media being such a huge part of the music business. Mm-hmm. But what it didn't bring with it at the time was a lot of video footage. And that was great, because my first shows were just, they just weren't good. I mean, I say, all of those label dudes that were like, we really like this music, can we come to a show? They would leave halfway through, because I would just fumble my way through. It took a while. Like, I had a ratio for a long time where I would keep score. I would be like, that was a bad show. And then I'd play another one, like, that was a bad show. And then I'd play a good show. Right. And I'd write it down.
Yeah.
And I honestly had a ratio of, like, if I can get this to 50-50, I'll be happy. Where, like, I didn't mess up, or I didn't stop halfway through a song, or I didn't, like, just start crying for no reason. Like, yeah. It's a complicated thing. Like, I was born with this obsession with music, and when I was a kid, it was wild. You know, you would listen to my parents, like, Chicago records and ELO records and random stuff, and it was completely non-specific. I just knew that I needed to listen to it all the time, and that then filtered into this thing where I just needed to make music. but it was chaos. You know, it took a long time for me to filter it into something tangible and meaningful. And I'm grateful for that. It was hard at the time because obviously, like I say, I knew that first record was good, but it took that first year of me playing bad shows and sort of like, you know, we got to the end of it. And I remember myself and my manager, Ken, we were in New York and I just licensed it to Vagrant. And I was like, well, how many records did we sell? And he was like, you know, like 2000. And I was like, you know, it was the disappointing thing to hear because I had really, you know, high hopes for it. But I was like, okay, it's a new year. Let's go again. And there was no sense of me giving up on it. And then the next year we sold like 150,000 copies.
Wow.
So, I mean, but that's, you know, I'm not a clairvoyant. I can't see the future, but like, you know, if you build something, I feel like I build things well. I feel like that's something, like in the same way that you're talking about Rick Rubin and these dudes and like, what are the gifts that you have? Like I can sing and I can write songs, but I feel like the thing that doesn't get talked about in this is like, you have to build stuff well. You know, when I built a song like Get Low, I felt like I built it well. I went into it with a sense of purpose and I'm not just like throwing it at the wall and hoping it'll stick or like specificity of purpose is pretty key in the music business. And I think it's the reason some people are still, you know, this is like, will be the 10th year coming up that I've been putting out music and I haven't dropped off and I haven't, you know, the music gets better and I think it gets better. And the new record is what I've always wanted to make in the way that I've never been able to make it before. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's all because of that stuff that happens.
You said that there was a lot of different textures on this album and like a lot of lot of different sort of like vibes and sounds, and I kind of get the vibe talking to you that like you weren't one of these like kids that was just into one style of music. I feel like you probably were like mashing it up.
Like what were you
listening to? Like what was like sort of like what are your real formative musical years? Like 13, 14, like what were you listening to? Were you like a new metal guy? Were you an emo guy? Were you like a...
Oh, yes to all of those things.
Same.
Like I think my formative musical years were probably between the ages of like 15 and 18 in terms of like forming like a musical vocabulary. And I think that a lot of it was to do with the fact that I made friends. Like up to that point, like I had a really bad eating disorder when I was a kid and it kind of debilitated a lot of my life from the ages of like maybe 13 to 16. Mm-hmm. But then when I kind of came out the other side of it and I started forming like the friendships that I still have to this day, that was where music, my love of music really kind of bore fruit. And it was definitely like new metal. This was like the, you know, the end of the 90s, start of 2000. So like, you know, there was like an obscene amount of music that has not dated well. You know what I mean?
like Papa Roach.
Mudvayne records, like some of it still holds up, you know what I mean? I still listen to a Slipknot record from time to time.
I still listen to Slipknot. I think Slipknot is definitely they've lasted the longest. Like I mean the stuff like Puddle of Mud and like POD Alive and some of the singer-songwriter sort of new metal stuff, which really wasn't new metal, but it was just on Kerrang around the same time, like Stained. Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. tough. You know what? There's some of it that's like unequipped, like is class. I mean, it's what it is. I'm on the outside.
I'm looking in. I can see through you. See you through colors.
It's a beautiful, beautiful rendition, and I hope you leave that in the podcast. I like, you know what I mean? There's a time and a place for all of this stuff, and it's like I would put my hands up and say I own probably 2 Stained records. I definitely owned that Disturbed record, The Sickness. Like I definitely was a big fan of Youth of the Nation by POD. Like yeah. I was a huge Incubus guy. Like, you know, Morning View was like
bass lines on that were amazing.
Yeah, but like there's like of all those bands, there's one that I think informed me the most and the one that I still like absolutely adore is Deftones. I think like White Pony for me is still probably one of the greatest albums like I've ever heard in my life. And I think that that's what's interesting and what I took away from that stuff is like there's a difference between like a band that were like a drop in the ocean and a band that are genuinely like seminal and transcendent. There's a reason Deftones are still huge today and they haven't dropped off a single bit in terms of their audience is because it's just brilliant music, and it was recorded really well. I can't remember, maybe it was Terry Date who recorded those, but like, it, you know, there was just certain music that just, they were just brilliant. And like Changing the House of Flies is a classic song, and so stuff like that. But I would listen to that, and then I would flip into like, that was the first year that, I mean, Justified by Justin Timberlake came out at the same time, and I was obsessed with that album, like, because I'm a huge Neptunes guy, like, and so like I never looked at it from like a fussy perspective. I didn't grow up in that sort of like the fussier side of the street. Like I liked bands like the Pixies, but it was before my time. And like, so when I came up, the music that was like very earnest was, a lot of it was bad. You know what I mean? A lot of it was like, for every like Linkin Park that I actually do think were a really great band, was like a really bad iteration of Linkin Park, you know? And that, so, but we all accepted it as incredible. we all did, as a very earnest, very like earnestly delivered important music. And then on the count back, you listen to it and you're like, you know, what was I thinking? But but at the time, you accept it with, that's the beauty of like, of being a teenager, is like you accept everything with this like vivid earnestness that doesn't question anything. So like I Enema by Tool, Deftones White Pony, like Pantera, you know what I mean, like Vulgar Display of Power. But then like Justin Timberlake, and then N.E.R.D. And then like, you know, I would listen to a lot of like really like the darker side of the hip hop world. You know what I mean? Like, so like there was like, it all just existed for me. And I didn't listen to it with any sense of like sarcasm or irony, or like, you know, I didn't put a thinking cap on when I listened to it. If it moved me, it moved me. And I think that's the musical vocabulary that I've always had, you know.
I didn't think about this until quite recently, actually until really yesterday. I don't know why I was thinking about it, but because I was just thinking about like how, you know, like grime culture and UK rap has really like taken off in the last, since 2014, since Skepta, That's Not Me came out, really. That was the UK's catalyst for its own rap scene, I think. Like, I mean, it's obviously been going for years and years and years beforehand, but that was the mainstream like flick that just put the switch on. Yeah. And I was thinking back to like when I was 13, 14, and we were like dressing in baggy jeans, wallet chains, FUBU jeans, Wu-Tang hoodies, red backwards hats. And I was like, yeah, we kind of dressed like we were like LA Crips. Yeah. but from Oma in County Tyrone for like 2 years.
Yeah, you were like the Oma Crips. That's so funny.
Packet of Crips.
It's not, you didn't do it with any sense of like, you know, it was just the thing that you did. You don't question it, right? Like, and I think that's something incredibly beautiful about that. And when you get older and you start to like realize that, like, I never knew Pitchfork existed when I was a kid. I don't want to keep harping on about Pitchfork, but like my point was, I didn't know that existed. I didn't know reviews existed. You know, like I didn't go to like, I used to read like Kerrang and I used to read NME, but if someone gave like, you know, a record 2 out of 5, I wouldn't be like, well, you know, fuck
that. I'm staying away from that.
No, I would go and listen to it because like the new, that was it. Like the new Incubus record was coming out, or like, and then it was the same with like hip hop records. Like I own so many hip hop records that are not good albums, but I bought because they would have 3 Neptunes beats on them or 2 Timbaland beats or that was the resonator for me. I didn't care about how it was perceived or what it meant. And when I got older and started making music and people started judging it and applying judgment to the work that I made, it had this very weird internalizing effect on me for a few years, where then I started to like bring that back into the music, where I was like, okay, cool. Well, these people like what I do, so I need to like play to that audience. Whether I had that conversation consciously or not, it happened in my mind somewhere and when in the music making. And the greatest, I've loved the fact that I've lost that over the last few years, because it's exhausting. It's exhausting trying to like make music for this, like this hypothetical thing.
You just make it for, like, the music that you make for yourself is the one that ends up doing the best, unless you like decide that you want to like make like some sort of post-Edwardian like Tin Whistle record or something.
Sting has made several of those albums.
I watched the Hollywood Reporter. They've got like a YouTube channel and they have a thing called the Round Table, and they have like all the actors all sitting chatting about their process and stuff, and half of it really interests me and inspires me, and half of me just makes me want to puke into my own mouth.
Yeah,
but like Sting, Yeah, talking about making loot records and like
loot.
Yeah, that's what his thing is. Like, there's Sting who likes the loot, and Martin Prince from The Simpsons who enjoys playing the loot, and that's about it. In the 16th century, maybe.
I love that with Sting. I mean, he's afforded himself the right to it. Yeah. The man is a genius. You know, he's into loots and writing musicals about the Newcastle Docks, and that's his vibe. More power to him, man.
Do you have like ideas for like, have you ever like gone like got these sort of like maybe slightly more left of, oh, that's my watch, sorry. Who still has a watch that goes off?
I know, I was gonna say, are you wearing a fucking Casio?
Casio, yeah.
Throwback, bro.
Do you have like one of those like odd ideas that you've got in the back of your mind that is so left from what you normally do that, but you still want to scratch an itch? Or like, do you know, like, do you have that musical idea? Do you have that concept album idea? Like, have you been talked out of it?
No, I think I'm too much of an asshole to like buy into my own bullshit. I'm very cynical. I feel like I'm the right side of the cynical line, but like, I definitely am too cynical to like think that like if those ideas do appeal to me, that they're anything more than like the ravings of like a out of touch like dickhead. Like, it's just like, and again, I want to be very specific. I'm not talking about Sting there. I think that you earn the right to do the things that you want to do in life in general if you work hard and do that stuff, and that's great. And some people just have that in them. Like I've never thought about rapping, but I love rap music because I know my lane.
Yeah, exactly.
But I have friends. I have friends that are successful musicians, and they're like, "Cool, now's the time for me to bust out my rap record," and then they play it for me, and I'm like, "Please, please, please, do not put this in the world." I should get medals for the amount of bad rap music I've stopped from emerging into the world from like rich like singer songwriters, because like it's just not needed. Like, you know what I mean? It's just, and now because like hip hop more than any anything is like so democratized, you know, like you can manifest your own destiny in it. So a lot of people are like, "Cool, man, like I'm an emo artist," and like everybody's listening to like Yellow Card. Like, you know what I mean? Like, people are listening to like emo records and making like, you know, Juice WRLD songs and stuff like that. So like, I can do that. And you're like, "Please, please, please don't do that. No one wants to hear it."
It works the other way around, right? Where like a rap producer or a rap artist can go and sample pretty much anything, because sample culture is part of hip hop and has been since the very beginning. Like, you can go and sample like Michael McDonald. You can go and sample like some weird old disco record, or you can go and sample like some flipping rock band, and that's totally fine. But you can't buy into, you can't go from rock into, well, you can go from rock into hip hop, which is new metal, which we were talking about. But I mean. With the varying degrees of critical success, but like, yeah, going from like a singer songwriter into rap, that very rarely works. I mean, it worked for Ed Sheeran, but I wouldn't even, do I call that rap? I suppose it is technically, but like,
I mean, it is technically, but it's
pop music.
And there is like, you know, there is that sort of rap sing thing that a lot of those guys do successfully. I don't think of it as rapping because I don't know what is rapping in 2020. It's a very like broad spectrum, and no judgments. Everyone is free to do what they want. I just like, me personally, I just know the things that I can do well, and I know the things that I could probably get away with, and I could probably be successful with. I think that's a thing too, is like, I'm not the guy for like the ruthless conversation about like, I can capitalize on this because this is like the buzzy sound right now, or I can make like an urban record. You know, like Get Low is an urban record. Like, we struggle with radio and stuff in the preamble, because like the label, when I submitted that song, like, and that album, they gravitated towards songs like Rising Water, because they were like, that's a song that we know we can make hay with at radio because it makes sense for you. And I always felt like Get Low was like the outlier on that album, because it just did something that I just knew was interesting, mm-hmm. and was good. And I articulated it well. I didn't fuck around with the sounds. I used the right people and I spent the time, but they weren't biting on it. And then when we put it out, just as like, we did it as like, you know, we're going to give it to Spotify and they'll put it on New Music Friday. And that was it. It was just supposed to be a track between singles, and it bounced. Like, as soon as we put it out, it just started to go very fast, and then they were kind of scrambling, you know, because they hadn't planned on it, because they were not thinking about it in that way, because they were in that box of like, this is the thing that you're known for, and this is the thing. So if you do the thing well, it can work. Like, you know, I knew I was in my lane with that song.
When you said earlier on that when you had a good show and a bad show, you would do it as a ratio and you wanted to get to 50-50. I think most record labels would be very happy of having a ratio of having hit records 50-50, because I reckon it's more like 80-20 in the other direction. Yeah. Like, I know from doing, like, you know, running my own label for like the last like 5 years, and I'm not saying I'm like I'm a Columbia Records or I'm a Island Records or whatever. Like, I'm a very small DIY label, but the ones we definitely get it right less than half the time, like on the singles that we think are the right ones to go out. And it's often the ones that you're like going, oh, we'll put this out as like the third one. Like, just goes blammo. And you're like going, I know absolutely nothing. And I think you kind of almost like need to admit that to yourself. Like,
yeah, I agree. I do think that there's like, sometimes, you know, like that's the thing I would say is like, sometimes I've learned to trust my instincts in music over the years, because I've thought a thing and I've done it and it's worked, and whether it's taken some time for to figure it out, it has worked. So like, I know sometimes when I'm making something, I know that like, this is the center of whatever the bullseye is that you want it to be, it's there. And then there's some songs that you just cannot predict and things that happen. And because there's 57 million ways to sell a record nowadays, it's hard to know, you know what I mean? Like, you look at people talk about like that Lil Nas X song and go, oh, well, you know, if it wasn't for TikTok and it wasn't for like him on Twitter, it wouldn't have blown up. And you're like, you're talking shit. Like, that song is brilliant. Like, it's just a fucking great song. And that's the thing. Like, don't let the conversation confuse you, because yes, he was very active on social media and he did get the song moving on TikTok. But like, that song, I think if you put that song in the desert, it would have found its way to where it wanted to be, because it's just that good. And there's other examples of that. There's like, there's a song by this artist called Joji that I love Joji, on TikTok too. Yeah. And like, that song was absolutely huge. And people are like, well, like this, you know, this is an example of this, how this happens. And you're like, those songs are just brilliant. Like, you know what I mean? Like, sometimes you just know, and sometimes you can't predict.
Yeah. There's this artist who's on, I think he's on the same label as you. And he only started out, I think this might be his debut single or his second single. It came out last year, or the year before. And it's stuck in my head all the fucking time. It's a Dominic Fike track, 3 days.
I love Dominic Fike. That song took like 3 years to be a huge song. Yeah.
But like it found its way, and like, you know, like the artist wasn't huge at the start when that came out, but that song stuck in my head all the time.
Yeah, no, and that's, you know what, that's, it's again funny, I feel like we're on the same page with a lot of this thinking, because Dominic Fike is someone that I talk about if ever I'm doing stuff with artists, which I haven't been doing a lot of lately because I've been making my own record, but like, if anyone wants to talk about stuff, I always use Dominic Fike as an example, because like, that Three Nights record came out, like, it was a big song in Australia when I was there like a few years ago. And I remember hearing it and thinking, this song is just like, I don't want to do anything other than listen to it again. And you know what I mean? And when those songs come along, it was the same with like the Portugal the Man record. Like, my old manager manages Portugal the Man. And when I heard Feel It Still first, like, I rang him and was just like, this is going to be the biggest song on the planet. And he was like, you know, we feel good, you know, like, you know, it's obviously tracking and blah 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 at radio, and he was doing all the managery stuff, but he's you know, so many different things need to happen. And you're like, you're absolutely right, but also like, no, this song is just, it has everything that you could ever want in a song. And I think that the paradigm is so weird these days, but the fundamentals are still the same. Like, if you sit and try and like really fucking focus in,
it's
on
just
something
that's annoyingly like, catchy. If it's annoyingly catchy, it'll do all right.
Annoyingly catchy is not the worst place to be, man. No, like, you know, definitely it's an interesting time to be making music.
I've got a question about you, like, because you've been all around the sort of the planet making music in different various places, but where have you settled now? Where do you live? Do you live in LA? Do you live in Canada? Do you live in Ireland?
I live in Dublin.
You live in Dublin? What's it like living in Dublin? And I mean, not right now in 2020, but like, just generally, because it's like Dublin's in a weird place. I think like it's like there's money back in the country, but it's not going to the right people. It seems like Dublin is a very strange place at the moment. I mean, everywhere is.
Listen, like, you know, you, everyone that has a very, like, I'm sure you have a up and down interaction with your hometown.
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
I mean?
Massively,
like,
yeah.
Like, I go through phases of, like, not, like, when I first broke as an artist, like, I was here and I was very happy for it because, like, you're really, like, lapping up that sort of, like, Dublin is a big city, but it's a small town. So, like, everyone knows you and everyone was kind of part of it. And that was lovely. And then for a few years, I didn't want to be here. I wanted to be somewhere anonymous. So, like, I moved to LA and I really loved that. And I looked at houses to buy. And then just when it came time, we just didn't pull the trigger on it. We just were like, no, let's just go back to Dublin. And then we came back here and then I bought the house here. And I love being, like, I live literally, like, you throw a dart and you hit the center of Dublin and I live there. And I love that because when you're travels as much as we do and kind of are very disconnected from a lot of stuff, it's important to be part of your hometown. So, like, there is that thing where, like, I agree with you. I think that, like, Dublin has become, I'm a little bit sad that we didn't learn more lessons from, like, the 10, 12 years ago when the world fell apart, that, like, Irish people, the greatest thing about us is our capacity to just kind of, like, and I don't mean this in a dismissive way, we have a capacity to suck it up and make it work. You know what I mean? Like, when the world fell apart and other countries were, like, you know, like, protesting and as you should, because it was the fault of these other people. Irish people were just like, okay, cool, we're just going to, like, do the thing that's required and we'll get it back on track. And we did. And it worked out. And that's amazing.
James, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for coming on the Stacker Podcast. Thanks for bringing your demo. Good luck with the rest of self-isolation. And may it not be too difficult. I don't think it will be, though. You, as you said yourself, you're fairly used to it by now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like a lot of naps.
Okay, thanks very much, man. And I will see you later.
Come on. Deadly. All right.
OneEightHundredFlowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way. Because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.